You see a door. Above the door is written,
Rusty.
Welcome to Doors and Dungeons Retro Gaming Podcast. This is part two of our discussion about PC 98. This is Rusty, and we're here with the creators of the 46 Okumin Translation Group. We have Thomas.
Hi.
Mike.
Hey, yep, hello.
And Max.
Hi.
Otherwise known as Skywells, Kuroshi, and Halloway Tape.
Close.
Oh, what did I do?
Kuroshi.
Ah, sorry. Messed it up there. Okay, Kuroshi, not Kuroshi. I don't know why I said that. So we've just taken some time in our last episode to really delve into the PC-98 and why you guys started on translating the PC-98. I really want to delve into a title that you guys worked on that is something that really fascinates me. It's a game called Rusty. And for people who are new to this, who don't know much about it, Rusty, I forgot who made this. It's like something with a B, right?
C-Lab.
Oh, C-Lab. Okay, for some reason I was thinking like Brand Marker, but that's something that's different. That's a game. Sorry, never mind. Yeah, C-Lab. That's right. Not C-Lab 2021, but C-Labo, is it?
Or
is
it just C-Lab? If you want to like be okay. Japanese about it.
And they made this game, and what year was this game released?
It's 93.
93, okay. And this game runs basically on your PC-9821s. You can run it on some 9801s if they're slightly higher quality, but this is a fairly graphic-intensive game for the hardware-intensive game for the PC-98 anyway. And basically, this is fan-made Castlevania without putting the Castlevania name on it for PC-98. In a way, it's almost similar to what Konami did themselves with the X68000 release of Castlevania. In a lot of ways, it's sort of visually kind of similar. Why don't you just give me a brief outline of what Rusty is to you?
I don't know if I would call it fan-made, because it was sold in stores.
Yeah. That's true.
I wouldn't go as far to call it like doujinshi, but it's definitely a Castlevania clone.
It's definitely made by people who are fans of the series.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. Yeah. It's not. It's a little bit choppy in terms of the way that you can sometimes move the character, but that's actually not too far off from a lot of the earlier Castlevania games. But generally, it's a pretty solid Castlevania clone. It's one of the better ones, especially during its time. It has great music. It has a huge variety of levels and cool bosses, and it's got some challenge to it as well.
I think we're forgetting the most important part in that. You play as a dominatrix.
Yeah.
And I think it's responsible for a lot of the appeal of the game.
I mean, if you look at her, that's all it is. Like, not in story-wise, I don't think she's a dominatrix. She's a hunter, or whatever you want to call it. But just by basic clothing and the whip in general, just being the main weapon, obviously, it's obvious what they were going for. You know, that's a pretty solid thing to assume that that's what they wanted there to be.
Well, when you think about Castlevania as a series, especially the earlier ones, I mean, that is kind of the natural extension of the idea. Because, I mean, the original games are, you're a dude in leather and a whip. And if you translate that over to a female character, especially on a system that's known for its, shall we say, less than prude level of content, I mean, that's what you're going to get. I mean, essentially, it's leather and whips. And what does that say, right? I do kind of wonder if there's like, for the developers, if there was any sort of subtext, sort of this leather-bound, like, dominatrix subtext in the original game when they were developing it, if they were wondering, it's like whips and leather, ha ha.
So we do have a slight bit of insight into that. It's not, like, a big insight, but we have been vaguely in contact with, not really in contact, he's on Twitter a lot, and he found out about our translation with Kajahara. He's the guy who did the PMD driver for the music and everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he was part of the staff on there, and he was seeing that people were saying that, you know, that it's probably Lusty, right? As in L-U-S-T-Y.
Ah.
And that's the first he'd ever heard of that. He'd never made that connection. So it's possible that it's not entirely intended on some of those parts, because they just called her Rusty, right? That was it. That was just her name. Nothing else beyond that. So, you know, tiny, tiny bit of insight. That's all we've got, though.
So he specifically didn't know that that was a thing. So the developers could have done it still, you know, as kind of a joke or something, or like trying to suggest that it's Lusty, but him just not know about it. It's possible either way.
It might have just been a cool word, too, you know, like, you know, how there's certain things that we'll just never know why the name was picked. Shortly before the podcast started, I was looking at some other things, and sure enough, Compile made a few games of, you know, themselves. Actually, one year before Rusty came out, and they came out with a game called Rusty as well. And it is spelled R-U-S-T-Y.
Huh.
It's some kind of detective game, but it is for PC-98, and it's something that would have been part of their Compile Disk Station magazine that, you know, they give you,
right,
like, software. But, it could be that maybe there was something around that era of early 1990s where Rusty was a name, and it just was popular enough to make it into the game.
I think it's important to note also that there was a sort of, and it's really kind of a niche thing, but in the 80s and 90s, there was a kind of a big sort of peeling back the layers behind the BDSM culture of Japan at the time, especially in a lot of the sort of the X-rated films of the era. There's this sort of underground, they call them pink films in Japan, or pinky films, I think it is. They're like really X-rated, like sneaking sort of beneath the radar of what the Japanese censorship laws will allow, that were really popular in that era. And during the 80s and 90s, because there was so much money in Japan, especially in the late 80s, that salarymen could just blow money on anything. And so there was this huge, like, fetish culture of people who would just, they would, you know, work their salary job, these seemingly normal-looking guys, and then they would go out after work, after their drinking party, and they would spend, you know, $300 on a few hours with a dominatrix, you know, whipping them and all the leather and chains and stuff. And there was several movies that sort of had this as core elements of their plot, trying to sort of take apart this culture in Japan, because there was, like I said, there just was so much money. And this is something that, if you've never been to Japan for any amount of time anyway, it's really hard to get a grasp on it. I don't know, have any of you been to Japan before?
Yeah, I've been 3 times.
Okay.
I've been a few times, yeah.
Okay.
I have not.
All right. So if you've been here, have you ever seen any of, like, the architecture or buildings or anything that were built in the 80s in Japan?
Yes.
So if you look at those, you'll see that the way things are built in the 80s and 90s, the early 90s anyway, the architecture is so much more ornate. There's so much, like, abstractness, and there's just money. There's just tons and tons of attention to detail that would not be in a building today, because there's not the excess money to go into it. And so when you look at, like, the PC market as well, you could have a system like PC-98 that cost $4,000 or $3,000, and there were salarymen that could afford to do it. So in this sense, because there was so much money in the market at the time, because it was this, like, huge bubble economy in Japan that was right on the verge of popping and sending a lot of people into financial ruin, you know, this core concept of things like BDSM and sexuality and, you know, these kind of things was there as long as you had the money for it. And so I think Rusty, in a way, to me anyway, is kind of an extension of that as much as it is an extension of Castlevania, which is just, it's a small thing, but I think it's something that's really important to note, because the culture at the time was so different from how it is now in terms of the way it approached sexuality and sexual, you know, repression and that kind of thing.
It's interesting to think about. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's something exotic to them. You know, anything that was, you know, new, exotic, from America or from Europe that was not previously there is something that I think would have appealed to a lot of Japanese people, or at least a certain niche.
Of how the game plays. You said it's like Castlevania. Can you give a little bit more detail?
I mean, so that's the main thing is you walk right and you whip stuff. And I mean, it has, you know, the statues in places, candles, you break the statues to find stuff in it. There's, you know, bosses that are generally you're fighting against vampires and the undead. But, you know, it's walk right, whip. It's got a clock tower seat level. It's got a graveyard level. It's got all sorts of things that are like the same kind of stages in Castlevania. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it is a clone, but it's a very well done clone that it has its own thing.
One of the bigger differences you'll see between this and Castlevania is there are lots of keys and gates. You get keys that are based on different card suits, and they're usually hidden in really far off places. So you get a really nonlinear level design where you can explore a lot more than the typical Castlevania gotta walk right all the way kind of levels that you would see.
And it's interesting that you should say that, Max, because really one of the first, you know, renditions of Castlevania was for MSX, Vampire Killer.
Yeah.
And Vampire Killer is very much like that. You have keys and doors, and you have to find the key before you can get into the door. And so it's almost like Rusty's kind of like a Vampire Killer sequel, more so than how Castlevania is.
Which is really funny because that game in particular, and then it's sort of spiritual seeker of Castlevania 2 are so disliked by most fans. Which is funny too, because they also spawn the modern Metroidvania series, you know, kind of roots, which then spawns its own sort of like craze that's really, really hitting its stride now, so many years later. And Rusty, in a way, sort of fits in with that. For me, I think Rusty is closer, if anything, is closer to the PC Engine Dracula X. Mm-hmm. In that it's still very linear in terms of its level layout, but then there's a lot more, there's still freedom to explore and find stuff within the level, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of like visual cutscenes that are sort of similar in a way, and part of that has to do with the hardware, because the PC-98 hardware is in a lot of ways somewhat structurally similar to the PC Engine, just partly because NEC made both, and so I think some of that graphics hardware kind of filtered back and forth between them a little bit, I think. So, like, Dracula X to me, and then the music also. Dracula X to me is probably the closest relation I would say to Rusty, but I wouldn't say that Rusty's anywhere near as good as Dracula X.
So, the fun thing about Dracula X, and I'm assuming you're possibly alluding to Rondo of Blood.
Yes, not the Super Nintendo.
That's what I was assuming we were talking about here, and I wanted to basically make that clear, because those two games came out within, like, what was it, a month from each other, I think is what we remember seeing? Maybe a few months.
That's something I was going to ask.
A very short time period. And they actually have, like, almost the exact same structure of game. Like, the stages are almost the exact same flow from, like, one ruined town level to a graveyard level to, you know, whatever else happens. They both have the clock tower level. They both have, I think, maybe even the same or similar number of stages. But we aren't even the first people to notice this. Someone else has already written up like a really big article about the similarities between Rusty and Rondo of Blood, and so they are like very much tied together in a weird way. And then we haven't really found the specific connection yet, but there is something there.
Now, remind me,
conspiracy theory that this is a secret Konami game that was just sort of given to another company and cleaned up, given a different protagonist, and released.
Huh.
I'm not saying that's true or anything. I'm just saying it is a theory that is out there.
Well, you know, I could see it. Now, remind me, does the beginning of Rusty, so I'll admit something here. I didn't get a chance to actually go back and replay Rusty before doing this podcast. I wanted to, and then stuff came up. Rusty's opening has, does it not have sort of an action sequence after the initial cutscenes similar to way Dracula X opens? Or does it just plop you into the first level?
That's the one thing that it doesn't have. Like, so you have the opening video, and then you start. But when you start, it actually has like a cutscene, but it's just talking. It's not like an actual action sequence like Rondo of Blood has.
You bring that up. The opening sequence kind of reminds me of the original Vampire Hunter D. Because if you've watched the original Vampire Hunter D, before D really hunts or kills anything, like, he visits a village and he sees that this village is suffering, and, you know, there's this, you know, everybody's kind of pointing their fingers, you know, over on yonder castle is where all the bad stuff's happening. And so he's basically collecting information, and that's what she's doing too. She's collecting information about, you know, where this evil lies, and she's going to go out and seek it. And I think what it does is it kind of gives a little bit of intrigue about her character, because she just kind of appears, you know, like she's on her quest or a journey, and she just happens on this village and finds that there's problems, local problems, that are related to the very thing that she hunts. And so I almost kind of see it as like a setup for sequels or prequels, you know, like she's been doing this for a while.
Which unfortunately never came, but it would be kind of cool for someone to go around and make their own sequel to it. I feel like with the way, I don't know if C-Lab is still in any existence in any form, or if anyone has the license to it, but it would be kind of cool for someone to do a fan sequel or prequel to it.
Amusingly enough, they do. As far as I can remember, C-Labo is still a company, but they have nothing to do with games anymore.
Huh.
Probably like Microcabin. Microcabin, they don't do games anymore either, but they're still around.
Yeah, I know a lot of these companies end up like switching over to like producing random hardware for like you know, vendors and stuff, like microcontrollers and weird junk, or like network cards and stuff, or like cable internet services or weird things like that.
And some of them make pachinko machines.
Yeah.
I mean, C-Lab was probably most successful with their paint program. It was multi-paint. That ended up being used to create a lot of visual novel type stuff.
Hmm. Was that on the
legacy.
Was that on the PC-98 itself?
Yes.
Okay. Let's turn to the music for a second. Do you know who designed the music for this game?
We did when we were working on it. I can't remember the name.
I gotta look
up now. I know, yeah, Kajahata did the PMD driver, which was a big part of why the music sounded as good as it did, because that was obviously the sound driver for the game. And then there were two other composers that are actually fairly prolific, I think. I just can't remember their names.
Kenichi Arakawa and Ryu Takami. And Ryu Takami is really famous.
That last one. Yeah, that's the one.
They ended up working on the composition for Yuno.
All right. Oh, right. Okay, I know who you're talking about. Yeah. He just died a few years ago, didn't he?
That was Umimoto.
You're right. Oh. Sorry. So that's a good point. We were talking about the PC-98 system in the earlier bit, and we didn't really go very much into the sound. Let's take a moment to discuss how sound works on the PC-98, because it's really relevant to Rusty, I think.
It was FM sound, which is, something that was a Yamaha sound card. And it was a 6-channel FM sound that was used for Rusty, I believe.
So for PC-98, though, there's several options in terms of how the sound works. So there's at least 3 different sound boards. Some of them have sound built into them, and some of them don't. And it also depends on what model you're looking at in terms of like the series, or 9801 or 9821.
It's just to kind of give an overview without getting too technical. It used to be PCM, and then after PCM, you started getting into the Yamaha FM sound. And the early Yamaha FM sound that was built on board with a lot of the earlier PC-98s, and even a lot of some of the PC-9821s that don't have the newer one, it was called the YM2203, and it was a 3-channel FM sound chip. And then they usually call that 26 sound, I guess, you know, YM26. But then the newer improved version, the 86 sound, was the YM2608 chip. And they call it the 86 sound mainly because there was a a sound card that was released called the PC-98. Gosh, I'm trying to think of what it was.
PC-9801-86, I believe.
So. Yeah, dash 86, right.
Yeah. And there was a 26 as well.
Yeah, there was for you know, just the machines that only had PCM and they didn't have any FM sound. So, you know, as FM became popular, you started seeing these modules or cards that would come out. And the same thing happened to, you know, MSX as well. MSX had a lot of these different sound formats, and you'd have to, you know, if you didn't have the latest and greatest machine at the time, you could get the sound boards to kind of help you out so that you can enjoy your games with full sound. But yeah, a lot of the newer PC-9821s, they sometimes would have that 86 sound built into the board itself. But for those that did not, you had to get the CBUS card, which is a you know, kind of like a PCI card, but a little bit bigger. And
a lot bigger.
It's yeah.
I mean, it's basically okay, double it's the size.
Bigger. Double the size of a PCI card. And it would fit into the back as a module. And with a little bit of configuration, you would, you know, then be able to use the 86 sound. Those cards are pretty desirable because some folks that don't have the 86 sound built in,
like
will order those, and they're going to be pretty expensive. But then there are some that get them just because it also had a controller port in there. Yeah, that's not uncommon for a controller port to come in a sound card. We even, you know, computers here in America, the controller port was usually next to the sound card.
Yeah, your Sound Blasters and stuff did that, and even a lot of the onboard ones in the sort of the late 90s, you'd start to have like onboard sound, but they'd still have the controller port sort of on the motherboard, but kind of going through as the controller going through the sound card system. And that's actually a good point too, because I actually just bought one for my friend, for the other Thomas. I'm fixing up a PC-9821 for him. It was one that I bought. I bought two. This is a fun story about my PC-98 history, which I should have told earlier, but I didn't, so we'll tell it now. I have two, well, I have three PC-98 systems. I have a 9801, sorry. It's a DX, I believe it is, and it's like a 286 with 2 5.25 drives, and it has onboard 26 sound, but it doesn't have a joystick port. And then I have two, and I bought them at a local recycle store. I have two 9821 X13s, which are like one of the last models they really, series that they released. And it's one of the least compatible in a lot of ways. It takes a bit of work to make them compatible with the early ones. But once you do, they work really well. One is a tower and one is like a desktop. And so the desktop, I had to actually take the front cover plate off for the floppy drives and insert a second floppy drive, because the majority of these games actually require two floppy drives to run properly, and this one only came with one. So I had to like find another floppy drive from a different computer and put it in there. Because again, the floppy drives have to be the same NEC compatible floppy drives. Put that in there. And then on the desktop, I have 2 5.25 drives that I put inside it. I mean, the tower. I have 2 5.25 drives that I put inside it and a CD-ROM. And then I have an external floppy drives. So I have 4 floppy drives on that one. 2 5.25 and 2 3.5-inch and a CD-ROM and an internal hard drive. And on that one, I put in a 86 board for sound. And then I also put in a graphics accelerator that allows me to do higher resolution graphics for Windows and stuff, which is really cool. So I can run Windows 3.1, or if I wanted to, I could run Windows 95 on it and actually have like a full VGA compatible graphics mode. But also, it can also use the earlier graphics mode for the games. And it's really bizarre, because what they did to do that was they actually have a video output and video input on the motherboard. And you run a cable, you run like a patch cable between your graphics card on your add-on and your motherboard's graphics port, and it outputs the normal graphics to an input on your new graphics accelerator card, and then sends that back out the output port, so that if you're using like Windows, it switches to the graphics card's mode, but when you're playing a game, it actually uses the motherboard's graphics. It was just really a unique take on it, but it's it worked fairly easy. And it's one of the things that I really love about the PC-98 series is that for the most part, even though that board, that the C-Bus board, is so big and so bulky, and you can only have a certain number of slots, they're really easy to work with. There's just a cover plate on the back. You take that cover plate off, and the boards actually slide in. There's a groove for them, and they just push right in, and they often have little tabs that allow you to pull them back out really easily. So they're really easy to take in and out and swap whenever you need to, which is so much better than having to take the cover off and remove the little face plate and put it in there and then put the... I hate all that. So I really like that about the PC-98. So, back to Rusty for a bit here, if we will. So the sound on it is really cool. The music sounds great, and it's one of my favorite parts of the game. I really, in particular, really enjoy the music of the opening sequence. What are you guys, what are your feelings on the music?
It's pretty kick-ass. I would say it's very Castlevania-ish. It's, you know, I think it's right at home with the folks that are going to enjoy Castlevania music.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there any, probably not, but was there any MIDI support in this game?
I do not believe there was MIDI support. I don't remember seeing it or seeing an option even for it anywhere.
I know there were a number of PC-98 games that actually did have MIDI support. If you had a MIDI synth card and that kind of thing, you could plug it in and you could, or, you know, like an adapter card, you could plug in a MIDI synthesizer. But I don't know. I don't think Rusty did.
No, I don't think it did.
If it did, it would be kind of like the ultimate Castlevania nod, because so many of the Castlevania games were designed around sort of the Roland MIDI hardware and then converted or so on. Especially like Dracula X again, which used like the Roland sound space to try and create a 3D audio effect. Which, if you've never done any research on the Roland sound space, it's really a really neat concept. It's basically like a MIDI-based... it's designed for Roland's MIDI stuff, but it actually simulates a 3D audio effect using stereo and it plays with like the spatial sound of the left and right channels in a way that you can probably do really easily with a computer now, but at the time, you really needed some very specialized hardware to do it. And they used that for Castlevania Dracula X. So it's really cool to see that, and I really wish you could. There was MIDI on Rusty, because I'd love to plug in a Roland synth and see how it sounds.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, that's one of the highlights of the Akumajo of Dracula for X68000 was
right.
You know, it really gave it three unique soundtracks depending on what you had hooked up to it, and so that would have been neat to have an alternative soundtrack. There was one thing I was going to mention to kind of add to the sound discussion. Is that, you know, one of the best games or series that I've come about that really allows you to just on the fly test the differences between all different types of sound is the Farland Story.
Oh, right.
The Farland Story series, it's you know, it's a tactical RPG type of thing, and it's, you know, it's a lot of them have actually been translated into English, which is kind of cool. I wouldn't say they're the most fun games or in the world. You know, just they're fun to mess around with. But what was unique about them is the sound test. You go in the sound test, and you can actually play any of the tracks from the game in 26 mode, 86 mode, MIDI mode, as well as CD audio if you happen to have the CD. So you get kind of four different soundtracks, and you can just flip to it at any point, which is really cool.
Wow, that is unique. I've never seen one do that with a sound test. I know Brandish allows you to switch in the settings between different modes like that, and I think they actually have MIDI for Brandish. I could be wrong, but I'm wanting to say they did.
They do, yeah. Okay. They did for some of it. Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know if you guys have ever used any, well, for Thomas, I guess, if ever used the MIDI on the PC-98. I don't have one of the boards, so I can't connect my MIDI synth. I've got an SC-88 Pro.
Yeah.
And I really want to try it out.
It'll be treated as a 55.
I really want to try that out one of these days with either an X68000 or with a PC-98, but I just don't have the interface board for it. Have you done it?
Yeah. I have. I've done it for both the X68000 and PC-98.
How does it sound on PC-98 games?
Pretty good. Pretty decent. I mean, it depends on the game. Some games, the MIDI music sounds a little off, but others it sounds incredible. Mm. Like, I think Farland's Story is a really good test with MIDI. I think it sounds great. And some games, the soundtrack just doesn't sound that great unless... I guess you can kind of tell, like, maybe the person that was doing the sound really had one particular format in mind, and then the rest was afterthought.
Yeah.
So like you get into a certain game, and maybe the FM sound kind of isn't desirable, but the MIDI is fantastic. They were probably focusing on the MIDI being the way to hear the game, you know, the definitive way to hear it.
That's to me the thing that I love about the Castlevania is that it doesn't come across that way. That on the X68000, that every single one of those is distinct and unique and has its own sort of depth and style to it. You could tell that they really took the time to make sure that each one of them was special. And if you've never heard the music from that, one of the cool things about it is that you can actually, the soundtrack CD, which I don't know how easy it is to find anymore, but I have it. The soundtrack CD for that, the Castlevania Chronicles for the PS1, that soundtrack CD has two discs, and on those two discs it has the remake music, the X68K's FM music, and both of the different Roland synthesizers music soundtracks. So you can get literally every version of it on in one CD set or two disc set, which is a really cool. Awesome. Yeah, it's a great way to compare them all and hear it. And I really wish a game like Rusty had done that. So what other key points are there that you'd like to mention about Rusty?
I would say that if you're playing it on an emulator, you might have a little bit of an easier time mapping the controls. If you're playing it on hardware, you kind of have to do some trickery unless you like to play with keyboards. I was using a particular joystick that maps the keyboard controls to the joystick, but I had a very, very difficult time really figuring out how to do it, because there are certain areas where you're going to have Rusty run and then do a jump in order to clear a pit. And the way that you run in that game is you have to hold up, and you also have to hit right or left. So if the joystick that you're doing doesn't support two inputs on the D-pad, then you're kind of in a world of hurt. So I had to actually remap a lot of the buttons so that I could actually have a button for up, and then I would have to hold that button down and it was just kind of tricky, because I guess I just enjoy playing it on real hardware. So why use emulation when you've got the real thing? I actually did a Twitch stream live from the PC-98 and beat the whole game over a series of different videos, and it's on Twitch. Mm. But it was certainly an experience.
Have you ever thought of transferring that over to YouTube or anything?
Possibly. Sure. Yeah. I mean, they're not bad videos to watch. There's a little bit of frustration for me at certain points in the game, but it's a very challenging game, especially. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like
lots of tricky jumps, and especially like the last level. Like, I don't know what it was, but the level previous to the last level, I was able to rack up like an entire series of lives, like extra lives. I think I had probably like 9 lives, like a cat. And I went to that last level, and I'm thinking, man, I'm going to rock this level. And I was down to like a thread of health left on my last life when I finished the game. And I was just thinking, like, how do people do this? You know, like, I got lucky.
The game rocked you instead, huh?
Yeah, I mean, and this is coming from somebody that I've been playing a lot of games. I've played a lot of action games. I platinum all the Dark Souls games. You know, I'm pretty well experienced with challenging games, and so yeah, this is definitely something that's going to be challenging, especially if you're not using like, you know, emulation state saves and stuff.
So that's
yeah, it really is something about those last couple of bosses. What's her name? Bloody Mary.
Bloody Mary
seems to be very, very random in her flying around and shooting things patterns. So I always lose a bunch of lives right there. And then, for some reason, I know the trick you're supposed to use in the very last boss, but I just can't do it very well. So I am a shameless save stater of Rusty, and it has served me well. Because it's quite difficult.
See, that's why you're doing well with an emulator. I also play it on original hardware, so I'm kind of stuck.
Yeah, I never beat it without save states either. I wasn't even going to try. I got to, like, I think I finally beat stage 4, and then I got to stage 5, and I'm like, nah, I'm just going to save state for the rest of this. It's not worth it. It's a good game, and I like it. I just can't. I'm not good at it. I'm never really good at those anyway.
I actually haven't played more than maybe the second stage because... I'm not very good at it either. I really love it. I really like what it's doing, and the concept seems cool. The music's amazing, but I'm not that great at it. And I've played a lot of Castlevania games, but it takes me a long time to get through some of those, especially the earlier ones. I'm not that great at them. I have to go back and check and see whether I have the same issue with the gamepad or not. I've got two different gamepads that I use. And I don't know if that's an issue with the gamepad or if it's with the actual input port. Do you know? Is it like the gamepad only outputs at a certain number of button presses, or is it the input can only read a certain number? Do you know?
My particular one, I think, is called like the JP-01, and it's I forget who makes it, but yeah, it's a programmable joypad, and you sometimes see them appear on Yahoo auctions. I've got two of them, but they're decent, and especially if you don't have a joystick port on the back of a PC98-86. CBUS card, but I would say that it's probably going to be dependent upon the controller. I'm sure there's some controllers that are going to support multiple inputs for the direction, but on a keyboard, you know, hitting up and left or right, that's no problem. But on a controller, I guess they're just not counting on you doing that. I know that diagonal support has been an issue with a lot of games, especially shooters and such, and so it just could be the make of the joypad.
I have to test that out with mine, because like I said, I've got two. They're very, very different, and I'll have to see how that is. I have, I got a 26 soundboard that I had bought. I thought it would be kind of a budget way to do sound. It's like a 26 compatible, and actually, apparently, it's slightly better quality than the NEC 26, because NEC didn't use a lot of really good resistors on stuff, or capacitors. And so I got that, and I thought, I'm going to try this out, and it's going to be great. It's going to be so much cheaper than buying an 86 board for this 21 that I've got. And then I put it in there, and it basically doesn't work. It's weird. Newer games can use it properly, like Brandish Renewal uses it great. And then, like, older games that were designed for the 26 won't work right on the 26 if you plug it into the 21, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And it's apparently something with the driver. Like, there's some sort of, like, flaw with the way 9821 reads the hardware. You have to, like, slightly edit the driver to make it work properly. And so the newer games have a driver that were designed to do that, and the older games don't. They were just designed to be 9801. But anyway, so I eventually what I ended up doing was I got a second 86 board that Thomas bought, and, you know, I bought it for him. To go in his computer when he gets it. So I've recently bought a second one, and it was, like you said, they're expensive. They are. They're still around $120 or so, $120 to $160 to get just that one soundboard. So I've got that, but I've also got this 26, and I put that into my 9801. So now I have two joysticks port on that. So I've got like three different systems I could test it out on. I need to do that. So I guess my last questions that I really want to ask is, why did you choose Rusty? You guys finished the Evo game, and then you moved on to Rusty. Why Rusty?
I feel like I was the one who chose this, so I guess I should answer this. So there was another PC98 ROM hacker and translator named Nana, and he was getting a bunch of requests for this game, and he was tweeting about it, and he said, the insides of Rusty are just a complete mess. I don't understand any of it. I said, oh, that sounds interesting. Why don't I check it out and see how much of a mess it is? And he was right. It was really messy. So this was actually before Evo was released. This is in about November of 2016. So I was taking a look at it, and all of the files were compressed. So there was no way to tell what was going on until I was able to solve that. So I spent a really long time on that, and I got really lucky, and the compression turned out to be something that was already documented somewhere. I think it was a Final Fantasy VII compression guide.
Huh.
And I just applied what I learned from that, and I wrote a decoder, and then I was able to take a look at what was actually going on. And then by that point, I had invested so much energy into it that I was like, hey, this sounds like a fun project. What do you guys think?
Yeah, so yeah.
It was a nice little project.
Wow. That's one of the advantages of having a team the way that you guys do, is that it not just in the actual translation work, but in the hacking work, having a dedicated translator to help with like guides and things, even just for the hardware end, because there's so much like documentation out there for this hardware that only exists in Japanese. So that's got to be like a huge boost.
Oh, this was an English guide that I used.
Oh, okay.
But I don't think I've ever. I've had Koshi translate error messages for me. That's been really useful. But haven't given him any full load documents to say, hey, I need this manual translated.
Oh, well, I guess there goes my idea out the window. But it would be a huge resource to me, I know, because I've been trying to look for it. For example, I've been wanting to try and learn about programming MSX games. And the way you start out with that is BASIC. I mean, all of these computers have some form of BASIC that they can use. And usually you don't do that for like the high-end games, but if you want to start out, you can use BASIC. And what I've discovered is that there's a lot of really, really great, really detailed information about how this specific hardware utilizes some of the intricacies of how BASIC connects to that specific hardware's capabilities that's only in Japanese. And with MSX, fortunately, there's a decent amount of like European information out there that's either in Spanish or in English that's slightly easier to get a hold of. But for a system like PC98, if you wanted to actually program for PC98, it would be a real challenge because the tools are going to be in Japanese. The documentation, pretty much all of it's going to be in Japanese. It would be a lot of extra work if you didn't read Japanese really well to try and go back and work on that hardware, I feel like.
On the plus side, though, speaking of that, some people in the PC98 Discord have managed to get an entirely open source version of, I believe, a C++ compiler and working in an emulator and on the PC98 itself now. So that is a thing that is happening. They are creating more Western-based tools for this kind of thing, so that it's in progress as far as I remember, but I don't know the specifics because I don't code that much, so I don't know a lot about it.
There's also some other things too that might be fun projects down the line, either if we were to do them or somewhere down the line another group were to do it. But there is a Dante, I believe it's called Dante 98 or Dante 2, and it's kind of like a precursor to RPG Maker as far as I understand. You know, there was a large scene of RPGs that were created by a fan community, and one of them ended up becoming pretty popular. You've probably heard of it. It's called Corpse Party.
Right.
That one, of course, has its roots with Dante being the engine that was used to create it. But there's also, I think there was like Shooting Maker 98, which I think has been preserved, both the guide for it and all of that. But if that were to be translated, it's essentially a great tool for making shooters on the PC98.
That would be really interesting, because I think to me one of the appeals of Rusty is the idea that you could take a concept like Castlevania and you could turn it into a game that runs on this computer system that perhaps isn't necessarily the best computer system for this kind of concept, but you could make it work. And it wouldn't take the vast amount of resources that it would take on another system. Like, for example, if you wanted to try and make a Famicom Castlevania game, like a new one, if you're going to try and make it work on the actual Famicom hardware, it's so much work. And I feel like if the tools are out there, PC-98 would be this wonderful developer system, kind of like the way the MSX is now, where there's like this big indie development scene that's popped back up in recent years. I would really love to see that kind of scene show up around PC-98, and I feel like Rusty proves that it's possible.
I want to go slightly back to something Sky was talking about, the Dante 98 2, the RPG Maker. So while we haven't specifically announced it for our thing yet, we're not exactly private with what we work on. Our stuff's all on GitHub, so we did actually just recently this past month put up a GitHub. What is it? What do you call those? Git? Is it a Git? I don't know.
A repo.
A repo. There you go. Repository for Dante 98. So it's a thing that we have been kicking around. So that one is actually more of a possible as far as like something from us. We haven't specifically announced it yet. But again, like I said, we're not private. There's a bunch of stuff in our, a bunch of repos in our thing that of stuff that we've been looking at.
Well, let me just tell you as a fan, if you guys ever did get around to doing that, I will be one of the first people lining up to use it, because it's been one of my dreams to actually create a game for one of these old systems. And 98 is the one that I really, actually 88 is the one that I would really love to work on, but that's basically a lost cause at this point. So I feel like 98 is like the closest equivalent to that. I would love to be able to make a game, any kind of game really, for 98.
Please. I mean, I've kicked around in Dante 98 too, and it's actually a very, I've been doing RPG Maker crap for like a long time. I never released anything because I've never really made anything worth releasing. But Dante 98 2 is pretty much what you would expect from an RPG Maker system on a DOS, you know, PC 98 environment. It has all of the exact same things you'd want. It might be more limited, obviously, because, you know, of the system. But it can make a decent game that comes with a tutorial game and everything that you can play through and figure stuff out, and it'll teach you how to use it. But it does not change from the basic core, like, RPG Maker system of, there are events, the events can do certain things, and that's usually, you know, NPCs, whatever, things like that. It's pretty much just RPG Maker, except, you know, before it got that name. So
right.
It's definitely a very good system to build stuff in, and that's why we do want to make it. We do the translation for it eventually, because we want to see if people would still do it, still make games for the PC-98, because they could with this kind of a tool. It'd be easy.
I would. I guarantee you I would. So there you go. That's one person. I remember I used, which one was it? Was it RPG Maker 98 back in the day on the early like Windows versions of it that were
95
like 95
is the first version.
95, yeah. That's the one that I used back in the day to create a few of my little early lesbian adventure stories of the era. I had a few little lesbian RPGs that were themed around that, which is a whole other story on its own. But I've always wanted to create more, I guess you could say, Yuri titles. That's one of my fun little goals, is to create like either a visual novel or an action game that's got, you know, a girl-girl relationship as kind of like the main, not necessarily like the plot driver, but just like a main point of the game. Because other than like really bizarre porny games that were made for guys to be like, you know, girls on girls, there's not really been any sort of serious LGBT anything. And I feel like it would be really cool to make that and be like the first to make that, like an actual serious, this is a game for girls who like girls on PC-98 or on MSX or something like that. And maybe that's also on some level why I like Rusty, because it's basically the Castlevania concept, but with a girl who's like a really strong, you know, kick-ass girl. And I always love when a series does that, unless they hypersexualize her, but.
Well, yeah, but also Rusty is also a girl saving other girls.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's kind of there.
It's basically there. Yeah, I'm not going to deny that that's part of the appeal for me. So I guess the last question that I had is there any other game that you're working on that you want to talk about or that you feel interested in? And also with that, can you explain to me a little bit about the Discord server and what impact it's had?
Well, our two current projects that are officially announced are Aparaden. It's a Japanese RPG about mythological and historical Japan. And that's, like, really close to done. It'll be out, you know, sometime. And we're also working on Different Realm, which is a Glodia JRPG.
Oh,
right. We just started that one. The interesting part of that project is that, you know, it's a really awesome game, but we also are in contact with one of the developers who sent us the source code and, like, a build environment for that game. So you can actually, like, edit the non-assembly code and, like, recompile it and get a new game.
Wow.
And it's also just a really, really interesting cultural artifact on its own. So I'm looking forward to exploring that in some more detail soon.
So that's one of the interesting things about PC 98 is that there's companies like you mentioned Glodia that are these really unique companies that made these RPGs and things that basically, for the most part, don't appear on other systems. I mean, I think, did Glodia also do Emerald Dragon?
Glodia did the original Emerald Dragons. Yeah.
And that got released on PC Engine, and did it also get released on Super Nintendo?
Super Nintendo, and that's the only version of the game that's been translated in any regard, and it's the worst version of the game.
Of course. But it's also the most accessible for most players.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm not
knocking
too much. That,
yeah.
It's good that it has been translated, but there are much better versions of it, being the PC Engine or the FM Towns are the two best versions, I think, of the game.
But the
Glodia,
PC...
I think PC Engine was a different company that developed it, and then Glodia... The FM Towns version is the specifically Glodia developed version. So, whichever one you want to go with, as far as like PC Engine probably has the better quality ish, but the FM Towns version is the better Glodia game, if you want to put it that way.
Now, did the 98 version, was that also done by Glodia?
Oh, yeah, no, all the PC versions are Glodia.
Okay. So, fun story on that. I believe you have a copy of that game, don't you?
Which one?
The PC 98
Emerald Dragon?
Emerald Dragon?
I believe Skywalls does, yes.
Yeah. Skywalls?
Yeah. It actually is a copy that belongs to you, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
That was sent to me by accident in a lot of games that were sent from Japan. So I'm going to be hopefully scanning that soon and getting that right back to you.
Sorry, I couldn't help but bring that up. Not as a pressure on you. It was my mistake. So one of the things, I'll just throw this out there, one of the things that I like to do, and this gets back to the Discord question, I am not a member of this group, but I... sort of kind of try and stick my foot in there in little ways. One of the things that I do to help you guys out is sometimes get you games because I'm in Japan and I can. One of the things that I do in terms of helping you get stuff is if there's a game that you guys think we're interested in this, we want to try and get it. Yahoo Auctions can be a really bizarre little mystery dungeon of its own to try and dig through because the people here are so quirky about how they do, like, who they'll sell to, the cancel bids on foreigners and things like that. And it can be really hard for someone who's not in Japan to get some of their stuff. So one of the things that I like to do is try and help get those games and then send them on. And in doing so, I accidentally sent one of my games with it, which was Emerald Dragon, which is also a Glodia game. One of the other ways that I got to help out is with Rusty, blowing my own horn here for what little value it is, which is basically zero. I designed the floppy disk labels for it. Woohoo! I don't know if you guys even remember that.
Yeah.
Yep,
I just
on the website
credited you
still.
Today. I forgot you were not credited for that.
Oh, that's fine. I don't care. Now, I was going to ask, is it still on the website?
Yes.
Yes, they are.
Wow. So, the funny thing about this is I really wonder if anyone has actually used them at all because I have not. I made them myself. I bought actual floppy disk label, like the sticky labels that you could get back in the day for printers to stick it in there and print it. And then I realized that the template that comes with these labels is not compatible because it's Japanese, is not compatible with the documents that I have the label in. So I have to like create a file that I can use to put these labels into the exact layout that's needed to print them, and I haven't gotten around to doing it yet. So even I have not used my own labels that I designed, which is sad.
Well, it's been downloaded a few hundred times.
Oh, yeah, I was going to look up the number.
Yeah.
It's been downloaded what?
160. They've been downloaded a few hundred times.
Oh, really? Wow.
I don't know if anyone has printed them, but they have. They've almost printed them.
Hooray!
Yeah, the 3.5-inch labels have been downloaded 160-ish times, and the 5-inch labels have been downloaded almost 100 times. So
wow.
There you go.
Hey, hey!
Whether they've been used or not, we don't know, but, you know, people have been downloading them.
Well, if there's any
send
listeners
us your photos,
out there.
Folks.
Oh, yeah, I was going to mention one other thing that was kind of interesting. We were talking about game preservation, software preservation, and manuals and things like that. Well, you know, we try to get, or I should say I try to get copies of the games that we're working on, mainly for preservation, but also because, you know, heck, it's something to be proud of. It's something we're working on, and who wouldn't want to own the original?
Exactly.
But for Rusty, I don't own Rusty. So then it comes a question of, like, well, how did we get the manual? How do we get the box art? And fortunately, there was another collector out there. I guess we can name him. His name is Yukin. And he has a pretty substantial collection of Japanese software. Mm. And he just happened to have this. And when we, you know, we were really looking to see if we could get a copy of the game and see if it would appear on auction. And we were, you know, to no avail. But because this guy had this and we're in contact with him, mainly through the Discord server, we were able to have him scan those. And he didn't have a scanner himself, so he had to actually take it somewhere to have it scanned for him.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, it's things like that, that, you know, that preservation and just knowing who has what that makes it available when you need it. And so there was a project that I was starting. I haven't really continued it because I just haven't had a whole lot of time lately. But it was basically a list of various games that have been scanned in and a list of games that people own and who owns them. And what they own of that game, like, do they own the whole thing? Is it full complete or is it just the box? And things like that. That way, if you want to just check it really quick to see if it's out there, if it's ever been dumped before, or if it's ever been archived, you can shoot right to it to get that information. Ideally, that's something I hope to make kind of open source so that people can edit it like a wiki or something. That would be great.
That's a good reminder for me because I actually have a few games that are not on that list that I need to scan and put on that list, and I completely forgot to do that. So thank you for reminding me.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these things are probably not going to get, you know, scanned unless we have time. But what it does is it helps us get an idea of who has what. That way, if for some reason, you know, there's a game out there that someone wants to translate, maybe they can prioritize that as the thing to scan next. Like, we have a fella named Dake who is part of the PC98 Discord, and he's very avid about translating a lot of the Puyo Puyo, what do they call it, the Monogatari?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so he's interested in translating a lot of those games because there's, you know, there's a big fandom for Puyo Puyo and those early Compile games. And so I know he's very interested in having everything that, you know, he can get his hands on preserved so that he can translate it.
And that's one of the things that I wanted to mention about Flodia and also with Compile is that in a lot of these cases, because these companies either don't exist anymore or because they quasi-exist, it's surprisingly possible to contact the developers and get actual help from them, which, you know, that sounds really ridiculous for an American to think, oh, like, this person would ever begin to take the time to pay attention to us. But I think it's different here because a lot of these people really put some of their, you know, their heart and soul into making some of these games. And once they disappear, because the Japanese idea is like, oh, well, it's gone. It's just gone. Some of these developers are like, golly, it'd be kind of nice if someone remembered this game. And then a group like you comes along and says, hey, remember this game? We're going to translate it to English. Instead of going, we'll file a lawsuit, blah, 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 they say, oh, please, can we help you? And that's really cool. And I think that's something that the internet in particular has made possible today where it just was not possible even, you know, 10 years ago.
I mean, full transparency, that is because of how cool the Glodia developer we're in contact with is. He already had a site that basically released one of the translation patches for one of his other games, Debon Belt, that Radical R worked on. He had that with an emulator and a fully packaged playable version of that on his site just already available for download. So I figured, you know, this guy would probably care. And sure enough, he did when we started talking to him about Different Realm. He'd also actually ported one of their other games, source ported Ragnarokker, I don't know how you want to pronounce it. That's ported to Java, he did it to Java, and then he did it to C#/Unity.
Oh, wow.
And so it's a Unity engine port of a PC98 game currently that exists. He hasn't obviously done anything with it, but he did it for, you know, fun. So he cares about his games. On the other side, I did actually send an email out to the director of Evo, and I never got a response from him. So, you know,
well, Enix, anything connected
to Enix.
Well,
this guy doesn't work at Enix anymore.
No, but anything connected to Enix, they're really particular about their licenses, I think.
Well, yeah, and yeah, I realize that, but it's one of those, you got to remember that you have to not just send a message to everyone you can. You have to actually see if they would be open to that sort of thing in the first place.
But even the fact that there are people that are open to it is kind of impressive.
Oh yeah, no, that is.
I think it doesn't impressive. Hurt to. I don't think it does. It doesn't hurt to try. I know our mutual friend from Finland. He and I are big fans of a particular series of games that came from a company that really only made like a handful of them. And they're action RPGs. They're Ys clones.
Oh, right.
But
is that Zach?
He reached out to not Zach, but he reached out to the creator of Aiza and
right.
Legends of
okay.
Loon. And those are ones that you kind of helped me, secure for me. But in his contact, you can just kind of tell that the guy, even though he doesn't do anything with this stuff anymore, he's just really happy that people are still playing his game. Mm. And he's happy that it's you know, gotten some traction outside of Japan even. And he even gave us a debug code for how to, you know, give the hero like unlimited money and health and live longer, punch harder, that kind of thing. So that's kind of really nice to have that now. And that too is information we can preserve that we would not have had we not reached out to the developer.
When you talk about documenting and sort of, what's the word for this? Preserving these kind of games. English failed me there for a second. Also, simple things like talking to these people can be such a huge, huge thing. And one of the things I'd love to do is actually get some of these developers onto this kind of podcast, because the goal of this podcast is to share these games that never made it to America to people who just don't have the same level of access that I do, or, you know, that other of us do. So I think that could be a really cool sort of a future goal as a translation group, to try and get some of these people on there, reach out to them, and just give them a voice, even if it's a tiny voice. Some of them is just knowing that even like two people care is something. And I mean, clearly if 160 people have downloaded the floppy disk labels for Rusty, like the interest, it must be out there.
Yeah. That's something that it's not impossible. I mean, just look at that stuff with John Sispaniak that, you know, he went to Japan and
right.
He met with a lot of the developers and wrote books about it and gained a lot of knowledge that we'll, you know, had he not done that, we would not have.
And that was one of the things that really struck me about reading that book. And for people that don't know, John Skopaniak wrote a book called The Untold History of Japanese Game Developers. I think it's like part one and two. And he also did like a DVD with it. You know, he did what you said. He just traveled around Japan and met with all these different developers. But one of the things that impressed me the most about it was the sheer number of people that were willing to talk. It just like the idea of being able to do that in America today just seems like so strange to me. And I guess some of those early people, like maybe Richard Garriott or what's his name, the guy that did Prince of Persia. Does anyone remember Prince of Persia guy? I guess not.
I know he wrote some books, but I don't remember his name.
I cannot remember his name all of a sudden. But anyway, Jordan Mechner. Someone like Jordan Mechner or Richard Garriott might, you know, want to talk about that. But the number of people that he got, that he could make two books out of, the number of developers that were willing to talk to him, which just stunned me. And it makes you feel like there's a level of connection that these older games have, because these people really did spend their time and energy making these games. Some of them, like, they went to their boss at a you know, an electronics company or at a, even one case, at a car company, and like sold car parts and said, I can make a game. And their boss said, all right, I'll take a chance on it. And they bought a computer and programmed a game, and they put all of their heart and soul into doing that. And it feels so different from like in the West, where from like 1990 on, everything got so corporate and everything got so like AAA titles. And there's indie developers now, but for a good 20 years, it was just corporate machine games. And in Japan, there's still the love for games out there. That a game like Rusty or a game like Aiza or what's the game you guys said you were working on?
Apparently, Different Realm.
Different Realm, yeah. Yeah, that you can still find the developers and talk to them because they just love this game so much. That's cool. And that's what I really want to share with people and really want to give to and add to. So I really want to thank you guys for coming on and talk about this. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for having us.
Of course.
No problem. And lastly, give me any websites or any information about, you know, contact or if people want to help out or people just want to know more. What do you got?
So our translation group has a website, 46okumen.com.
Can you spell that out just in case?
46okumen.
Okay. And is there any information about the Discord group? I know that's kind of, I think that's still semi-private, isn't it? Or is it?
No, it's not really private. I mean, some of the people might want to keep it private, but I don't see why. There's a link on our website also to the Discord. If you needed to get an invite to the actual Discord, you can get in that way. What else? And we're also pretty active on Twitter, too. So all of our stuff's on there.
And what are you on Twitter?
Things. Just Kuoshi. Kuoushi for me.
All right.
And I'm Skywells. I have, Skyewellse. And I go by RetroType, which is my domain name, but I don't really do anything with it other than host other sites.
And I am Holloway Tape, but my Twitter, unfortunately, is Holloway Tope, HallowayTaupe.
I never noticed that.
I didn't either.
Someone else got to it first.
All right. Well, thank you very much again, and I hope you guys have a great evening. And also, if you're really interested, look for the Discord server. I know it's been a big help for me. As a hardware user, I was able to get so much information and get hardware to work that didn't work for like 2 years. So it's a big, big help. And it's just a really cool group of people. So please go out there and learn more about these cool systems. And
it's also very active, I should say.
It is very active.
300 plus members.
This has been the Doors and Dungeons Retro Gaming Podcast. And I want to thank you all for listening. And if you really want to check me out, you can find me on Twitter. It's at DoorDun Podcast. That's at Door, D-U-N, Podcast. Check that out. Also, you can find our Patreon. It's patreon.com/doorsanddungeons. And there you can donate to do cool things like listen to episodes sooner than the other people as soon as I figure out how to do that, and get your name in my book as soon as I get that printed, which should be sometime coming up early next year, and other fun things. So, stay tuned. There is a special Christmas episode that's coming up very, very shortly, probably within a day or two, so please check that out. I hope you're going to love it. I really know you will. I put some real heart and soul into it and got a lot of great stories from users, so that's going to be lots of fun. And lastly, I want to thank everyone who's been waiting long for this episode. It took me a long time to get around to editing it, and I'm really, really sorry about that. But it's done now, so hooray! And I want to thank everyone in the forum again so much for all of your help and also for being on this podcast. So we'll see you next time. I'm your host, Michelle, and keep playing games. New slogan for you. Now here's some music.